Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
In my road trip across America to uncover the dark truths about sundown towns, I find myself in Martinsville, Indiana, which has a long history of being a sundown town. I'm here to investigate the brutal murder of a young African-American woman who stayed in Martinsville after dark, and it cost her her life. In a county that historically had the biggest population of Ku Klux Klan members than anywhere in the country, has Martinsville shed its image? I was able to speak with the mayor of Martinsville about the town's sundown past.
I don't like to refer to Martinsville as a sundown town. That's by a minority group of people who use things like that. We always have racist people in every community that stir things up.
It was here in Martinsville on the evening of September 16, 1968, 21-year-old Carol Jenkins was murdered selling encyclopedias. Jenkins, fully aware of the mores of the city, was caught in town after dark. Carol was stabbed in the heart and left for dead about an hour after police had investigated a complaint that she had been harassed by two men in a black sedan. In a town not too far from Martinsville, a visit with the Jenkins family to learn more about Carol and their reactions the night they received the devastating news 45 years ago.
What type of person was Carol?
She's my stepdaughter, but she's my oldest child. And she's the sweetest little thing. Of course, I fell in love with her when I first met her, you know. She grew up to be an intelligent, loving young lady.
So sweet, so affectionate, so caring, loving to everybody.
When she got older, she was attracted to different things. She liked to teach children.
Her ambition was she was going to be a teacher. And that's what she was working toward at the time her brutal murder.
Knowing that there are places out there like a Martinsville, how did that play on you growing up?
It's always had a history of for no black person to be there after the sun goes down. Be careful if you got to go through it, because it's just a bad town for a black person traveling.
I'm in Martinsville, Indiana, where 45 years ago, 21-year-old Carol Jenkins was murdered after she lost contact with her carpool of co-workers who were selling encyclopedias. She ended up getting stuck in town after dark, and it cost her her life. I learned that Carol desperately tried to elude a car that was following her, so she frantically knocked on the door of a young couple. Newlyweds Don and Norma Neal were the last people to see Carol alive.
What thoughts came to mind when you see that this young black woman in fear, and she's knocking on the door for your help?
She said, "Oh, please, let me in. I've been followed and harassed by two men in a car." I opened up the door and let her in. I didn't hesitate.
The car pulled up in front of the apartment with its parking lights on. And she said, that's the car. So we run around, and I tried to get his license number, but I missed some letters or something.
Were you able to see inside the vehicle?
There was two silhouettes in the vehicle. They had their inside lights off. You couldn't see.
The Neils quickly called police. Fortunately, it appeared they weren't very interested in pursuing those who were harassing her and seemed more troubled by the fact that there was a black girl in their town after dark.
Why wouldn't the officer wait with her so she wouldn't be alone? It's like they just left her there like a lamb, you know, to the wolves.
I had talked her into staying with us. She changed her mind. And she said, I have bothered you people long enough. And I kept telling her, you're not bothering us. I begged her. And I can still to this day remember her walking off. If I could take it back and know what we know now, that girl would have never left our apartment. I wouldn't have let her.
It makes me kind of ashamed of Martinsville.
So you're newlyweds, actually, and you're dealing with not just the death of Carol, but, you know, you're being harassed.
They wanted to know why we did
why
it.
Why we helped. I had somebody kick our back door in, trying to get in one evening. They knew when I was at my parents' house, was harassing me, told me they was going to come and kill me. And my father actually said, I didn't know this until later.
Years
later, that he sat on the front porch with a shotgun.
All night.
All night long, waiting for them to come.
After Carol's murder, local and state authorities began investigating the case.
How did you feel about Martinsville investigating the case?
They just messed it up. They didn't get any information. And I thought you were supposed to bring in the family. It was like they totally shut us down.
Now, I felt like that they botched the whole thing to start with because she had too much stuff scattered and people was picking up some of her belongings that she dropped.
At the crime scene itself.
Yes. Of course, they said, well, they didn't know that she had been stabbed and they didn't rope any of it off.
So the crime scene itself was contaminated.
Multiple suspects were brought in for questioning, but they all led to a dead end. The case stood dormant until 2002.
Context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, May 30th, 2019. So I have been told this is our 13th study session on racist suspect James Loewen's Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. We are slowly encroaching upon the end of the book. We opened the audio segment from Keith Beauchamp's The Injustice Files. Mr. Beauchamp is a two-time guest on The Cows. That documentary. It's about 45 minutes. It's about Carol Jenkins. We read about Carol Jenkins' murder in Martinsville, Indiana, Sundown Town, last week. And that segment, Mr. Beauchamp and Mr. Loewen, if you watch it, they go to Martinsville and get more information about the killing. The only thing I'll say, the Neils, white family that allegedly harbored Miss Jenkins briefly before she was killed, her Mr. Neil not getting the license plate information, and then Mrs. Neil not either making the black female, the victim, stay and or escorting her to get to her next destination. I think both of those, in my view, are suspicious acts from a white person. They live there. They're white, the Neil family. They know what it means to be white, and they know the racism of the town. They knew the danger that that black female was in. She had already told them that she had been stalked. Why not escort her? If not, sorry, you're going to stay here until, because, you know, these crackers around here are dangerous. Why not say that? Anyway, we will pick up Context of White Supremacy, Sundown Towns, audio segment number one.
Stereotyping other groups. As Martinsville's assistant police chief demonstrated, residents of sundown towns often don't confine their generalizations and stereotypes to African Americans, although blacks have usually been viewed as the most menacing. Sundown towns are more likely than other communities to oppose additional they's, other racial groups, gays and lesbians, unusual religious groups, hippies, and Americans who look different or think or act unconventionally. At East High School in Appleton, Wisconsin, for example, formerly a sundown town vis-a-vis African Americans, conflicts between Hmong Americans and whites were a daily occurrence at the school in 1999, according to reporter John Lee. Quoting a student source, Lee wrote, "Usually it begins with a group of white students taunting an Asian student or his friends with epithets, or pushing them into lockers." He said the white youths pick on anybody that's different or anybody who hangs around them. Meanwhile, at nearby North High School, incidents occurred between white students and Mexican Americans. On the day after white students had defaced a Mexican flag at North, white students came to school wearing Confederate battle flag symbols hanging from pockets on shirts and on car antennas, according to reporter Kathy Newfer. They already owned these symbols, giving the conflict a white supremacy tinge. Residents of several sundown towns have told me that their towns also harass homosexuals. Springdale, Arkansas, made news in 1998 when every candidate for mayor, speaking before members of the Christian Coalition, attacked the Human Dignity Resolution, passed in nearby interracial Fayetteville. One mayoral candidate even proposed posting "No Fags in Springdale" signs at the city limits, reminiscent of the sundown signs that Springdale used to sport about blacks. Of course, many interracial small towns also manifest hostility toward gays and lesbians. Such hostility shows itself more easily in sundown towns, however, with their heritage of inhospitality toward an entire outgroup. On the other hand, not every sundown town is as anti-gay as Springdale's. Gays live safely, if semi-closeted, in Cullman, a sundown town in northern Alabama, for instance. And some more or less came out in June 2000 via a story in The Advocate, the national gay and lesbian news magazine. Conversely, some racially integrated towns and neighborhoods, including New Hope, Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia, and Mount Rainier, Maryland, outside Washington, take quiet pride in welcoming even out gays. Regarding religious deviance, we might first recall that the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s was anti-Catholic and anti-Semitic, as well as anti-black. And of course, most elite sundown suburbs also kept out Jews until well after World War II. Some also barred Catholics. In Santa Fe, Texas, a sundown town, Philip Nevlo, the town's only Jewish student, said in 2000 that schoolmates had subjected him to 2 years of anti-Semitic harassment, including threats to hang him, and police charged 3 students with making terroristic threats. Santa Fe's reputation for being white only, in the words of Shelley Kelly, archivist at the University of Houston, surely contributed to the climate of intolerance with which his parents charged the school district. Other sundown towns attacked leftists and labor leaders. A decade after Harrison, Arkansas, expelled its African Americans, its large Ku Klux Klan chapter targeted striking railroad workers, and in 1923 hanged one striker from a railroad bridge, herded the rest together, and escorted them to the Missouri line. The result was a sundown town so far as organized labor was concerned. The same thing happened in Bisbee, Arizona, known as a white man's camp, after it expelled its Chinese miners. On July 12, 1917, Bisbee expelled more than 1,000 striking miners, members of the Industrial Workers of the World, Wobblies. Across America, working-class whites today complain about getting stopped and harassed by police in elite white suburbs. Some sundown towns give a hard time even to white heterosexuals if they seem different. Based on bad experiences in Marlow, Oklahoma, poet Jody Bateman generalized, "I think the stories of attempts at exclusion of hippies and hitchhikers would make another sundown town book." From this, I believe that the sundown town syndrome in very small towns isn't just racism, but a fear of all outsiders who don't seem respectable enough. A web post makes the same point about another Oklahoma town. "I'm from a small town of 3,500, Stillwell, Oklahoma. I couldn't wait to get out of that place. The grapevine is as brutal as they get. I find in towns with no cultural diversity, there's a cruelty toward folks that are different. For the longest time, there was a sign outside of town that read, 'Don't let the sun set on your black ass.'" When a town goes sundown, the exclusionary mindset stays for a long time and festers and generalizes. Whites in sundown towns speak authoritatively not only about African Americans, but also about leftists, Muslims, poor whites, union members, or welfare mothers, based on little or no first-hand experience with members of the class. Surely African Americans, Chinese Americans, Jewish Americans, Seventh-day Adventists, gay Americans, lesbian Americans, hippie Americans, poor Americans, and mildly non-conforming Americans can't all be the problem. Hence, being unwelcoming to every one of those groups obviously can't fix the problem. Abraham Lincoln understood the threat to our democracy posed by anti-black prejudice, and the likelihood that this sentiment would metastasize to attack other groups. In 1855, he wrote a letter to his lifelong friend Josh Speed, a clause of which has become famous. "As a nation, we began by declaring that all men are created equal. We now practically read it, 'All men are created equal except Negroes.' When the know-nothings get control, it'll read, 'All men are created equal except Negroes and foreigners and Catholics.' When it comes to this, I should prefer emigrating to some country where they make no pretense of loving liberty. To Russia, for instance, where despotism can be taken pure and without the base alloy of hypocrisy." Surely Lincoln was right. Surely exclusion itself, not African Americans, not all these other groups, was and remains the problem. Readers might consider if they'd feel comfortable in a typical sundown town, in Appleton, Wisconsin, say, before it cracked, or Stillwell, Oklahoma. The answer for non-whites is obvious. But whites, too, can be at risk if they say the wrong thing, bring home a partner of the opposite sex who's of the wrong race, or, horribile dictu, bring home a partner of the right race but the same sex. Even if they avoid these transgressions, would whites feel comfortable raising children in a sundown town where the only thing worse than having children who just don't fit in might be having children who do? inculcating prejudice in the next generation. Cognitive dissonance also helps explain how young whites wind up racist as they mature. Racism isn't genetic, of course. Sundown towns help to maintain it. Many sundown towns chose American history textbooks that paid little attention to African Americans and Native Americans for as long as they could. They also preferred the old Dick and Jane readers, in which all the characters were white. In the early 1970s, when textbooks became more multicultural, the head of the Follett Publishing Company observed, "The day of the all-white textbooks is just about over. The big publishers won't fool with them anymore, and all-white towns like Cicero, Illinois, just won't be able to get them in the future." Despite the efforts of adults, childhood isn't a straitjacket, and it's certainly possible for a white child to grow up in a sundown town and not become racist, or to transcend that racism through later life experiences and education. John Wooden, the famous UCLA basketball coach, grew up in notorious Martinsville, yet coached such famous African-American basketball players as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Sidney Wicks. Presidential candidate Wendell Willkie opposed racism after he left Elwood, his Indiana sundown town, although he never did anything about it while he lived there. Nevertheless, teachers who try to convert white young people in sundown towns to an anti-racist position fight an uphill battle, at best succeeding one student at a time. All the while, when whites don't go to school with blacks and don't live with blacks, and everyone in town knows this results from whites' choices and policies, it's hard for children to conclude that blacks are okay. Logically, they may infer quite the opposite. Sometimes, having been a sundown town can poison the atmosphere even after a school goes majority non-white. In 1991, Pam Sturgeon, who is Anglo and was president of the school board in Hawthorne, California, another Los Angeles suburb, said, "When I went to Hawthorne High, Hawthorne was a sundown town. All blacks had to be out of town by sundown or be in jail." By 1991, Hawthorne High was majority black and Hispanic, with considerable conflict between those groups. The teaching staff was still largely Anglo, including many holdovers from its all-white days, and some of them contributed to the problem by refusing to teach works by such authors as Richard Wright and Maya Angelou. Sturgeon referred to the sundown legacy, "A lot of adults in my age group are fighting that bigotry within themselves." These considerations are perhaps clear for the classic independent sundown town like Martinsville or Sheridan. But if it's unhealthy to bring up children in such obviously racist environments, is it somehow healthier to raise them in sundown suburbs like Hawthorne before it desegregated? Or worse yet, in such elite sundown suburbs as San Marino? There, the social structure implies that it's correct to distance oneself not only from African Americans, but also from the white lower, working, and middle classes. Can that be good for children to learn? Yet every year, thousands of white parents move to, rather than from, sundown suburbs, and they do so for the children. It would be far better to raise children in towns that don't declare in their very demography that white is right. To some white parents, all this is obvious. A new homeowner in a former sundown county outside Atlanta said that many houses in her community were going up for sale because the community is becoming more racially mixed and the white people are moving further south. The funny part is that I've been wanting to move because I can't stand the thought of my future children growing up around such racism and narrow-mindedness. So I suppose their moving is making my life easier. Independent sundown towns limit the horizons of their children. Independent sundown towns have another effect on their residents that has nothing to do with race, at least not directly. They narrow the horizons of children who come of age within them. It's an axiom of American small-town life that youth goes elsewhere to become somebody. Young people in independent sundown towns typically hold ambivalent feelings toward the outside world. Some decorate their bedrooms with posters of Michael Jordan, formerly, or Serena Williams, currently, or even a black rapper if they feel rebellious. They're very aware that the outside world differs from their circumscribed little world. Indeed, like their parents, high school and college students from all white towns and suburbs exaggerate the differences and routinely estimate that the population of the United States is 20-50% black. So they're wary of the outside world and not sure they want to venture out there. For the most part, most high school graduates in independent sundown towns don't venture far. One of the first things I noticed in conversations with young people in these towns was their circumscribed aspirations. Basically, they didn't go anywhere, a woman from Anna, Illinois, said about graduates from Anna Jonesboro High School. Bill Donahue followed the high school students from Nickerson, a sundown town in central Kansas, when they took their class trip to Washington, D.C. in 2002. There were a few Nickerson kids who yearned for a broader existence, he reported. For many students, though, the Washington trip would be a first and last hurrah. He talked with their teacher, Gary McCown, who said with sad resignation that he didn't expect much worldly ambitions from students in Nickerson. They look at what their parents do and what's offered around Nickerson, mostly service jobs, and they think, it's not a bad life. It's pleasant. You can walk into the grocery store and be greeted by people you know. When students from Pena High School in central Illinois do go on to college, it's mostly to Eastern or to the community college in Mattoon, according to a former Pena resident. Eastern Illinois University, formerly Eastern Illinois State Teachers College, is located in Charleston, 50 miles east of Pena, and almost as white. Mattoon is closer still. Although the University of Illinois, a world-famous institution, is only about an hour from Pena, few students make the drive even to check it out, and fewer still enroll. School personnel can't recall any who chose the Chicago campus of the university. Students who venture out of state don't venture far either. And afterward, most return to Pena. They like the small town life, a recent high school graduate explained. It isn't just preference for the known, however, but also fear of the unknown. My sister's actually frightened, said a woman who years ago moved to much larger and interracial Decatur. Frightened of cities, frightened of anything she's not familiar with. Such fear marks many small-town residents. But in sundown towns, the fear of African Americans looms foremost. Young adults in Pena granted me a certain respect upon learning that I grew up in Decatur. It's pretty rough over there, isn't it? Actually, it isn't. They just think it is, believing Decatur to be heavily black. When high school graduates from independent sundown towns do break out, it can be very scary for them. Chantel Shearer, a 1988 graduate of Sullivan High School in central Illinois, put it this way. I remember growing up in Sullivan, where all outsiders were made to feel unwelcome. I love where I grew up. But yes, this unrealistic living situation had its implications when those of us who lived there grew up and moved away. I remember being afraid of all the different people when I was 17 and a freshman at college. There were over 30,000 students, representing a huge variety of people. Many people have told how coming from a sundown town made it awkward when they tried to play a role in the larger society. For example, a recent graduate of Granite City High School in southwest Illinois said that his teachers would warn students before field trips to St. Louis, "Don't tell people you're from Granite City. And for God's sake, don't tell people you're from an all-white high school." Of course, such an admonition could only make them less at ease in St. Louis, and the resulting parade of emotions, shame, fear, self-consciousness, discomfort, may provide additional reasons not to venture out next time. The apprehension of residents of independent sundown towns about the outside world often prompts them to inflate their town beyond reason, perhaps to convince themselves they aren't missing much and made the right choice. "They think they're in the middle of the world," my Decatur informant said, characterizing her Pena relatives. "They don't know how small and how backward they are." Deep down, this ethnocentrism is defensive and carries with it an element of socialexia. Deep down, residents of independent sundown towns know that they do not live at the center of the universe. Their put-downs of the outside world are only a flimsy shield against that knowledge. Here's an obvious example from someone using the identity "Gone a Viking," posted to the online discussion site alt.flame.niggers in May 2001. "Do you want some pictures of niggers hanged in the town square, or what? Like folk Arkansas for the 'nigger don't let the sun set on your ass' sign in that town? Lots of loggers and farmers down there richer than any nigger in the USA. 80 acres of pine 50 years old equals $1 million. 23 million niggers equals pure shit." In fact, Oprah Winfrey by herself probably has more net worth than all 814 residents of folk combined. In some part of his or her mind, Gone a Viking surely knows that. Young people who do break out of the cocoon get derided for it by those back home. A student at the University of Illinois, Chicago, told how her friends back in her sundown hometown asked her, "Why would you go there?" She pointed out that Chicago was world famous for architecture and music, among other things, but that persuaded no one. Friends of another student were more blunt. "Do you know what you're getting yourself into? There's colored people down there." "Why would you want to live in Washington, D.C.?" inquired hometown friends of Kathy Spillman from Tonawanda, a sundown town near Buffalo. They seemed to have no idea, Spillman noted, that the Smithsonian Museums, concerts at the Kennedy Center, theater all over town, and restaurants featuring cuisines from around the world might actually interest someone. Spillman has no patience when these queries cross the line into overt racism. "People from Tonawanda ask me, 'How do you live with all those niggers down there?' I reply, 'I like having sex with them.'" Many parents in independent sundown towns are content to have their children stay close to home. "They don't seek opportunities to go to cultural events," Susan Penny said about residents of Oblong, Illinois. "They don't leave town except to go to sporting events. They don't expose their children to different milieux on vacations. Instead, choosing places such as Branson, Missouri, where the entertainment will be familiar and the audiences white. According to Penny, they don't even try ethnic foods." Elite sundown suburbs limit their children in other ways. Young people in working-class sundown suburbs behave much like their compatriots in independent sundown towns. They stay close to home unless service in the armed forces breaks through to enlarge their horizons, racially and occupationally. Young people in elite suburbs such as Beverly Hills, California, Edina, Minnesota, and Darien, Connecticut, display behavior that's both much the same and much different compared to that of their counterparts in independent towns and working-class suburbs. These young people have grown up with a sense of entitlement. The world is their oyster, and they intend to harvest its pearls. Their parents, especially their fathers, mostly don't work in town, but in corporate headquarters in the central city or suburban office parks. Their jobs take them across the country or across the world. Their frequent flyer miles take their families for vacations across the country or around the world. Parochial, they aren't. Yet parochial, they are. Families like these can go to Bali and never meet a Balinese family, because they stay in the Sanur Beach Hyatt. Like the residents of Pena or Tonawanda, young people from elite sundown suburbs can't conceive that another place might be superior to their own hometowns. Unlike the residents of Pena or Tonawanda, they're not secretly defensive about that. They're truly ethnocentric, which makes it hard for them to learn from other races and cultures. There is also evidence from social psychology that students who discuss issues in multiracial classes display higher levels of complex thought and are thus better prepared for college. The residential segregation by occupation that marks elite sundown suburbs limits their offspring in another way. It enhances social distance. Since most of the people who work in these suburbs can't afford to live in them, not just the maids and gardeners, but also the teachers and police officers, these adults aren't really available to children growing up there as any kind of positive role models. Many children in elite suburbs end up not only ignorant of such human activities as carpentry, but subtly disdainful of them. They never encounter people in the working class on a plane of social equality. This limits their own occupational horizons and prompts them to feel that they've failed if they don't make it into an elite white-collar occupation. Sundown towns collect racists. Thus far, we've discussed effects sundown towns and suburbs have on people who live in them. Yet these communities not only create racists, but also attract whites who already believe in white supremacy. Ever since they began advertising themselves pridefully as all white in the early 1900s, sundown towns have attracted people who want to live in all white communities. Families have moved to Marlow, Oklahoma, because there were no blacks in the schools there. To Bishop in southeastern California from Los Angeles, because they don't want to deal with those people anymore, and to Cullman, Alabama from Birmingham, to avoid integration. Kelly Burrows, a 1988 graduate of Havana High School in western Illinois, wrote in 2002, "I lived in Havana all my life and knew of no African Americans that lived there. And yes, the rumor that you heard was a wide-known fact amongst the community, that niggers weren't welcome to purchase or live in our town. As to that holding true today, I don't know. I no longer live there. But if you find out, please let me know so I can move back." Burroughs went on to explain, "I'd like to see more all-white communities. Would I like to live in an all-white community? Hell yes." Once racist whites congregate in sundown suburbs or towns, they tend to keep them all white. Newcomers usually join in happily. As noted previously, a series of violent incidents by whites kept African Americans out of Wyandotte, Michigan, an independent sundown town that was becoming a suburb of Detroit around World War I. The largest single expulsion took place in the late summer of 1916. City Assessor F. W. Little blamed that riot partly on the influx of Detroiters who, feeling the penetration of Negroes in Detroit, sought Wyandotte real estate on the basis of their past knowledge of the anti-Negro attitude in Wyandotte. Retirees are free to choose new communities in which to live, unencumbered by the need to commute to work. Often they select towns because they're all white. One of the selling points for retiring to the Missouri and Arkansas Ozarks has long been their racial composition. A 1972 survey of residents of Mountain Home, Arkansas, found that many were retirees from northern cities, especially Chicago, and chose Mountain Home partly because it was all white. According to a 1980 article on Polk County, Arkansas, it's not an uncommon experience in Polk County to hear a newcomer remark that he chose to move here because of low taxes and no niggers. A store manager in the late 1990s in the Rogers, Arkansas Mall confirmed, "It wasn't uncommon for folks moving down here from the Chicago area to retire to openly remark that one attraction of the Rogers area was that there were no blacks." A resident of Pena, Illinois, told that white Chicagoans also moved there to retire, knowing its anti-black tradition, and have radically racist ideas. Florida is, of course, the nation's premier retirement destination, and northern newcomers, not just retirees, deserve much of the credit for that state's extraordinary residential segregation. Carl Fisher, founder of Miami Beach, exemplified those outsiders. According to the historian Alan Rauker, Fisher was appalled by Jim Crow practices in Florida, but he excluded from his developments both blacks and the wrong class of Jews. The influx of northern retirees after World War II hardly opened communities in Florida to African Americans. On the contrary, Florida wound up with the highest levels of residential segregation in America. Recall D, the index of dissimilarity, which can vary from 0, perfect integration, to 100, complete apartheid. By 1960, Daytona Beach, Fort Lauderdale, Jacksonville, Lakeland, Miami, Orlando, St. Petersburg, and West Palm Beach each had a D greater than 96, close to total apartheid. Scoring 98.1, Fort Lauderdale was the most segregated city in the nation. In contrast, Pensacola and Tampa, Florida cities that were not primarily destinations for northern retirees, scored closer to the southern average of only 90.9. Racist organizations favor sundown towns. Sundown towns provided fertile recruiting fields for the Ku Klux Klan in the 1920s and still do today. This might seem absurd. Why would whites living in places that face no possible threat from other races mobilize to protect white supremacy? Again, cognitive dissonance supplies the explanation. Living in all-white towns encourages people to support organizations advocating that kind of social structure. Whitley County, Indiana, had about 100 African Americans in 1880, but just 4 by 1920. In 1923, a Ku Klux Klan leader, spoke at a large rally in the county seat. "I want to put all the Catholics, Jews, and Negroes on a raft in the middle of the ocean and then sink the raft." According to Kathleen Blee, author of Women of the Klan, the crowd applauded wildly. In overwhelmingly white towns across America in the 1920s, the Klan held parades and rallies that drew the largest single gatherings these towns have had to this day. Down through the years, Klan leaders have often located in sundown towns. In Indiana, in 1923, the Ku Klux Klan attempted to purchase Valparaiso University in Valparaiso, a sundown town, to be its official college. The Klan never came up with the money to complete the deal, however. Edwin DeBar, leader of the Oklahoma Klan, made his home in Norman, another sundown town, where he headed the School of Pharmacy at the University of Oklahoma and was the university's first vice president. A headquarters of the Illinois KKK was Pekin, also a sundown town. Today's Ku Klux Klan, much less centralized than the 1920s version, has one headquarters in Harrison, Arkansas, up in the Ozark Mountains, in the words of The Economist, a part of Arkansas from which blacks vanished almost entirely in the early 1900s and to which few have returned. For a time, another Klan center was in Ross, Ohio, a distant suburb of Cincinnati. The first African-American family moved into Ross only around 2000. Other KKK groups have set up shop in sundown towns in Pennsylvania, Michigan, Texas, and other states. Over the years, many other white supremacist organizations and leaders have also sought the supportive environments of sundown towns. In Aurora, Missouri, in 1911, Wilbur Phelps founded The Menace, an anti-Catholic newspaper that had a circulation of 1 million by 1914. Father Coughlin, the notorious radio anti-Semite of the 1930s and 40s, broadcast from Royal Oak, a sundown suburb of Detroit. His followers smashed windows of Jewish shops in New York City in the early 1940s, emulating the Nazis' notorious Kristallnacht. Gerald L. K. Smith, a right-wing extremist and radio evangelist in the 1930s and 1940s, devoted his magazine, The Cross and the Flag, to exposing the workings of an alleged international Jewish conspiracy. When he ran for president on the ticket of the Christian Nationalist Party in 1948, his platform included deporting African Americans from the country. After meeting opposition when trying to locate in the Los Angeles area, Smith moved his headquarters to Eureka Springs, Arkansas, partly because it was all white. Smith died in 1976, but a passion play and the statue Christ of the Ozarks, both sparked by Smith, live on in Eureka Springs. Robert Welch, founder of the far-right John Birch Society, charged that an international communist conspiracy was behind the 1954 Supreme Court decision that called for schools to be desegregated. The Birch Society has had headquarters in Belmont, Massachusetts, San Marino, California, and Appleton, Wisconsin. All were sundown towns, I believe, and San Marino also kept out Jews. Today, many right-wing racist groups still find havens in sundown towns and counties. The intelligence report, put out by the Southern Poverty Law Center, is the most complete national list of extreme right-wing and racist organizations. Groups on that list are disproportionately headquartered in sundown towns, or frequently recruit in them. The Southern Illinois Patriots League, for example, is in Benton, Illinois. East Peoria is home to Matt Hale, inventor of the World Church of the Creator, a white supremacist religion that inspired a follower to go on a 1999 shooting rampage in Illinois and Indiana against people of color that ended with 3 dead and several others wounded. Even when headquartered in larger interracial cities, such organizations repeatedly meet, march, and recruit in overwhelmingly white towns, such as Parma, Ohio, Elwood, Indiana, and Simi Valley, California. Richard Barrett runs his nationalist movement from his home in Jackson, Mississippi, but held rallies in Forsyth County, Georgia, on Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday in 1987 and again in 1997. He noted gleefully, "The census lists 0.00% of the population of the all-American county as African," and called it Fortress Forsyth. Many residents in all-white or nearly all-white counties and towns disapprove of white supremacist groups. Nevertheless, the style of rhetoric that we've seen is customary in communities with a sundown legacy confers upon these groups a form of legitimacy. As David Zimmerman said, discussing the KKK chapter in Harrison, Arkansas, "Maybe the Klan's here because it's comfortable here." Tom Robb directs the National Knights of the Ku Klux Klan, pastors a Baptist church, and publishes The Crusader, a Klan magazine, in Zinc, a tiny suburb of Harrison. He agreed in 2003, "I moved to Boone County in 1972 from Tucson, Arizona, to raise my child in an area that reflects traditional American cultural values." In 2002, a leader of Aryan Nations announced that his organization was moving to Potter County in north-central Pennsylvania, precisely because it's so white. Even when located in isolated small towns, these hate groups often have considerable influence through music, literature, and word of mouth with white young people, especially prisoners, throughout the United States. Thus, not only do sundown towns and suburbs affect how their own residents think and behave, they also affect the larger society. The impact of sundown towns and suburbs isn't limited to whites. The next chapter asks the opposite question: what's their impact on African Americans who don't live in them? Sundown towns and suburbs are based on the premise that African Americans must be kept out because they're likely to be problems. When that ideology reaches African Americans, as it inevitably does, the result is not happy. Chapter 12, The Effect of Sundown Towns on Blacks. Daisy Myers, pioneering black resident of Levittown, Pennsylvania, writing in 1960, said, "We'd realized years ago, to our sorrow, that the housing market, above all else, stands as a symbol of racial inequality." In conversation with each other, many African Americans believe that when racial privilege is at stake, Caucasians, the term often used, are to be feared. "Whites'll stop at nothing," a sociologist friend said to me. I thought he was overstating his case. But the actions whites have taken to maintain sundown towns and suburbs support his position. We've seen that the deepening racism of the nadir, exemplified by its progeny, sundown towns and suburbs, not only affected where African Americans might live, but also how, by sapping their morale. Through the years, sundown towns and suburbs have influenced the thinking, modified the travel behavior, and limited the opportunities of African Americans who never even set foot in them. The ordinances, restrictive covenants, acts of private violence, police harassment, white flight, NIMBY zoning, and other mechanisms used to maintain sundown towns have also contributed, we'll see, to a certain wariness in African American culture, leading to a persistence of caution that in turn helps maintain sundown towns today. In metropolitan areas, sundown suburbs in turn gave rise to overwhelmingly black inner-city neighborhoods and a handful of majority black suburbs. This residential segregation continues to take a toll on many African Americans in the present, making it harder for them to achieve the cultural capital and make the social connections that lead to upward mobility. The ideology that drives sundown towns and suburbs, that blacks are problems to be avoided, also hurts African Americans psychologically, especially when they internalize the low expectations that result from it. Feeling ill at ease. Especially during the Nadir, travel was difficult and often unsafe for African Americans, and not just in the South. Older African Americans can still recall how trips had to be meticulously planned to reach places with restrooms or overnight accommodations in a timely manner. A resident of Rochester, Indiana, recalled that a black chauffeur died in his car in about 1940 because he wasn't allowed to stay in a local hotel. He'd rented a room for the little white boy he was chauffeuring, but wasn't allowed in himself, and he either froze or was asphyxiated by exhaust fumes. Much more common was mere humiliation. Until well after the passage of the 1964 Civil Rights Act, which outlawed segregation in public accommodations such as restaurants and motels, African Americans coped by compiling guidebooks of places that wouldn't harm or embarrass them. Families also assembled their own lists and shared them with friends. Or they stayed home. Speaking of her childhood in the 1950s, an African-American woman said, "We didn't go on trips. My father absolutely refused to take a vacation. Part of that was because he worried about being terrorized on the road." Terrorized is an appropriate word choice, because segregation, and especially sundown towns, rest ultimately on the threat of terror. Her family lived in Mattoon in central Illinois, surrounded by sundown towns. Not only do these communities tell African Americans that many white people consider them so despicable that they must be barred en masse, they also serve as a reminder that we don't really live under the rule of law where black people are concerned. Although any stop for gas, food, or lodging might prove humiliating to the black traveler, sundown towns pose the worst hazards. In other towns, even if hotels and restaurants refused to serve African Americans, they could secure shelter within the black community. Sundown towns had no black community, of course. Worse still, black travelers were acutely aware that they stuck out in these all-white towns, not only as unusual, but also as illegitimate and unwanted. Allison Blakely, professor of African American Studies at Boston University, recalls that in the mid-1960s, blacks were afraid to drive through Grant's Pass or Medford in southwestern Oregon. A black friend of mine put a loaded pistol on the front seat of his car when he drove through those towns. To this day, some African Americans are very aware of sundown towns and their reputations, even in distant states. Even benign experiences in sundown towns made impacts that lasted for decades. Jocelyn Landrum Brown, a psychologist at the University of Illinois Urbana, grew up in Indianapolis. She wrote about a trip she made with her parents to Greenwood, 10 miles south of Indianapolis, in about 1960. If you'll recall, My parents had gone to Greenwood to pick up a puppy from one of my mother's co-workers who lived there. I overheard the grown-ups talking about how we had to get out of town because black people weren't allowed in town after dark. I remember being terrified, sitting in the back seat of our car holding my new puppy as we drove from Greenwood to Indianapolis. I believe this memory is behind my fear of driving rural highways and traveling through small rural towns, particularly in Indiana. Owen Cole interviewed an elderly African-American who, as a young worker in the Civilian Conservation Corps in the 1930s, rode through Taft, California. As we entered the city, a sign read, "Read, nigger, and run. If you can't read, run anyway. Nigger, don't let the sun go down on you in Taft," he told Cole in about 1995. "The importance of this experience is that it remained vivid in his memory," Cole notes. Many years later, he's still able to remember the entire wording on the sign. Sundown town reputations remain vivid and current in African-American culture. A 70-year-old black professional woman in an interracial town in central Illinois put it this way in 2002. "You didn't stop anywhere. There was a lot of fear. There still is. I had to go down to Effingham, a notorious nearby sundown town, recently to observe, and I wasn't happy about it." Many older African Americans are still reluctant even to enter sundown towns. The former CCC worker went on to tell Owen Cole, "Even today when I visit Fresno, I make it a point to bypass Taft." An African American professor at Southern Arkansas University related that as of 2001, blacks don't stop when they pass through Sheridan, the town 30 miles south of Little Rock that got rid of its African-American population in 1954. A resident of Paxton, a sundown town north of Champaign, Illinois, said in 2000, "I invited a black man who wouldn't drive into Paxton for Sunday dinner. He'd come only if I drove him." An elderly African-American woman living in central Missouri avoids the entire southwestern corner of that state. She's very aware that after whites in Springfield, the prime city of the Ozark Mountains, lynched three African Americans on Easter Sunday, 1906, all the blacks left out of that area, as she put it. Neosho, Stockton, Warsaw, Bolivar, and other Ozark towns are almost devoid of African Americans, who fled the entire region, she said. "Even today, those are not places where I would feel comfortable going." Particularly within their own metropolitan area, African Americans know well which suburbs don't welcome them. Only 9% of African Americans in the Detroit area in the late 1990s said they thought Dearborn, the sundown suburb just west of Detroit, would welcome a black family moving in, while 86% said the family would not be welcome. In a 2002 article in the Detroit News titled "Invisible Boundaries Created Dividing Line Between Black, White Suburbs," David Riddle, a Wayne State University history professor, explained that the violent anti-black events of the 1970s in the sundown suburb of Warren still affected that city's image three decades later. "When a municipality acquires a reputation like that, I think it's self-sustaining." A professor of African American studies at Bradley University in Peoria told why he wouldn't consider moving to nearby Morton. "Clearly, what I've read about the area influences me. Based on what you know, you don't feel comfortable raising your family there and exposing your children to those influences." Writing about mere segregation on the 50th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education, Colbert King, who's African American, agreed with the decision's language. To separate children from others of similar age and qualifications solely because of their race generates a feeling of inferiority as to their status in the community that may affect their hearts and minds in a way unlikely ever to be undone. It does affect you as a child and later as a grown man, King wrote, in ways unlikely ever to be undone. There is a wariness you can't shake. Historically, the still more hurtful existence of sundown towns and suburbs made many African Americans justifiably fearful, less apt to explore new experiences and locales. Even today, many African Americans don't feel that the world is their oyster, ready to be explored and enjoyed. And why should they? It would give anyone pause to realize that merely being in a town after dark can be a life-threatening offense. This worry about acceptance, this feeling ill at ease, is the opposite of white privilege, that sense of security felt by upper and middle-class whites, that they will never be challenged as out of place.
Racism is not a privilege. Racism, white supremacy, is terrorism. This is the Cows, Gus T. Renegade. That was the first audio segment of James Loewen, Suspected Racist. His text, Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism. We'll pick up the next subsection is Black Avoidance Helps Maintain Sundown Towns. That's where audio segment number two will begin. The number to dial if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, anything stood out in the first portion of the reading, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Quickly, before we get to folks who dialed in, just the situation with Carol Jenkins, or not situation, the murder of Carol Jenkins, a 23-year-old black female, killed in Martinsville, Indiana, 1968. That was at the very end of the audio segment we did last week, and he picked up talking about Martinsville, Indiana again this week. And I said at the beginning after the audio segment from Mr. Beauchamp's film that the Neal family, these are the whites, who allegedly harbored Carol Jenkins shortly before she was killed. I said at the beginning that the Neals, even their conduct, should be looked at with suspicion. Mr. Neal, not getting the accurate information for the license. And then his wife, when Carol Jenkins says, oh, I'm going to go, you know, you're white. You know, hey, these Martinsville racists, wow, they are super dangerous. There's no way that you can leave. You're going to stay here. Or if you can't make her stay, I'm going to escort you. Those are your options. It's super dangerous. There's no way that you're going to leave here. I would feel like I'm an accomplice in some way, shape, form. I'd be responsible in some way. Either you're going to stay here until your vehicle or however your transportation is going to be arranged, or I'm going to escort you to wherever you're going to make sure that you get there safe. Matter of fact, me and my husband, I feel like whites, they have way more resources to do things. To make sure that, you know, racism, white supremacy doesn't happen. In addition, the reason that I am even more intense with regard to my suspicion of even them, because the language used by Miss Jenkins' family was that the police botched the investigation, and they're victims of racism, but just words are important. He said they botched the investigation. They didn't tape off the crime scene. They didn't realize that she had been stabbed. And so the crime scene was contaminated. They didn't collect evidence, all of that. That's not a botched investigation. That's not laziness. I think that was the language that was used in a report where the same thing happened with a black person in the 21st century. That's not laziness on the part of the police. That's not that they botched the investigation. That is, they practiced racism, white supremacy until evidence proves otherwise, that they, just like all the other whites in Martinsville and elsewhere, do not value black people. They're niggers. So no, we don't care. No, we're not investigating. No, we're not taping off the crime scene. You're going to tell me that trained enforcement officials, even in 1968, that they can't recognize, oh, it looks like that might be blood there next to where this nigger is on the ground. Maybe she might have been stabbed. I don't know. Maybe we should roll her over. Is that part of the protocol? Roll over the body and see what exactly we're dealing with? Or we don't do that with niggers. We don't do that. Okay. That's not botched. Very important. That's not botched. That's not a mistake. That is racism, white supremacy, and total disregard for niggers. This is what happens when there's a new coon in town. Isn't that the acronym they used earlier in the book? Right on. Get to folks who dialed in. *61 if you have questions, comments, things that have been standing out in the text. All righty. Go through a nap.
Can I be heard?
Greetings, retired firefighter. Yes, sir.
Greetings. First, before I forget, I heard the word prejudice at least once during the first reading, which is a word that when the global system of racism and white supremacy is being referred to or talked about or commented on, that word should not exist. I heard the city that is called Stillwell, Oklahoma. That is the home of Oklahoma State University, which was and is only about maybe 10 miles away from Langston University. I think it was equated as a sundown town. I'm not surprised. I'm trying to revert back to something like the 1970s as far as my time that I was in the state of Oklahoma in that area. And just about the only thing that we would go to Stillwater for is when we would train practice at that particular college, because we didn't have an artificial turf field. We would go there to, we would be invited by the school to our team, is what I'm saying, football team, would be allowed to practice there during that week, because we would be playing a team that had a similar surface to Oklahoma State University. But by the end of the sun went down, we were definitely out of Stillwell. As young non-white black people, we would do a lot of risky things, and but it wasn't often. But for the most part, the only thing I can remember being in Stillwater in the dark would be at a restaurant eating pizza. That's the only time I can remember that we would be in Stillwater other than football practice. I think they already mentioned Norman, Oklahoma, which is the home of the University of Oklahoma Sooners, the famous Sooners, which I'm not surprised. I suspect also that in between Langston, the two small town, Guthrie, Oklahoma, and Coyle, Oklahoma, were similar to what the author is describing as sundown towns. I don't recall having any place to go into either one of those towns after dark, especially. On to directly with the book itself, I have down here notes in order to the first part of the reading was about the way of screening sundown towns, the deliberate and precise and military-like process that white people did and still do. And I have done in order to keep their environment white, racist, pure as possible, white neighborhoods would eliminate all instances of opposing social, sexual, and political behaviors which directly help support, which would not actually help support the system of racism, white supremacy in that part of the world. They would eliminate, because by the standpoint of white people wanting to be as strong as possible in their daily activities, any countering or odd like behaviors, they would even check the white people that would carry on such behaviors, because they know that would possibly threaten the system of racism, white supremacy in itself, ultimately. So I can see that being a strategy. Matter of fact, it makes it much more easier on the more national level for white professional politicians to be able to know on what areas that they don't have to do as much work in order to be hired for a position, because they know that area basically would support them based on how they have done most of the work of politicking for that individual person, just by them screening their towns in the same light that this white individual person is broadcasting on a more broader basis, national, international, that sort of thing. Last but not least, I have down here to grow up in one of these areas. Oh, because he was talking about, which I think he was alluding to, that a white person growing up in an area like this, it would be some sort of hindrance to that white person. And I disagree with that. I haven't seen, there's no proof into a white person growing up in an environment that's called a sundown town, or even the situation where he was talking about how they were screening even white people for different types of behaviors that would not be sufficient, where that has actually harmed a white person from attaining any particular goal that they want to achieve, or anything in that light. So I don't know where he was coming from with that, other than practicing racism himself by being deceptive. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Deception, primary method of the practice of racism. Other folks who dialed in, if you have a hand up, comments you would like to share, *61, feel free. While folks are getting their notes together, I'll share a few notes took from the first portion. Keep an eye out on the switchboard for other hands as I see folks dial in. Let's see. I've said this throughout. We've been reading this book for a few months, for most of the spring now, and I think a theme for the text could be white children, the role of white children in the administration, preservation of sundown towns, all white towns. He has so many examples of whites being involved, whether it's rock throwing, whether it's actually being involved in the purging of black people, the school incidents. It's tons of these in the text. And he starts off this week where he has a school example. And this is white students pushing and picking on so-called Asian students. And then he had another example of them pushing on and beating up so-called Mexican students. White people talk to their children. They talk to each other, period, about racism, and they certainly make it mandatory to explain the business operations of white supremacy racism to their offspring. This is one of the best books that I've read that really emphasizes that, and from a generational perspective, where this is something that is a major component of how white supremacy is passed on from one generation to another in terms of the knowledge of what racism is, how it works, what it means to be white is passed on. He says that one of the mayoral candidates proposed no fags in Springdale signs at the city limits, reminiscent of sundown towns that Springdale used to sport about blacks. I thought that was extremely important because frequently one of the ways the deception of white supremacy, they will compare racism to lesbian, gay, LGBTQ, AI, you can just keep adding on letters. And that's what I mean. There have been so many illustrations of sundown town signs. No niggers allowed. Nigger be out of here before the sundown. Nigger, read and run. And if you can't read, run. It's so many of these signs. Where are the signs that say no fags allowed? Read, gay, and run. And if you can't read, run. Where are those signs at? I have never heard of that. And certainly, even if I did, because I'm certain they could come and produce. Oh, there's one right there. Sign, see it right there. No fags allowed. Okay. But I mean hundreds. That's what he's saying in this book. Hundreds and hundreds that are uniquely, specifically, explicitly focused on purging black people. You just don't see that with gays. And I thought it was extraordinarily tacky and an act of racism to have a whole section talking about how so-called sundown towns are also restrictive and also exclude so-called gays. And he had such a big group, gays and poor whites, lesbians, nonconformists, whatever that means, all of that vagueness when he's already said it contradicts what he said at the beginning of the book, that these sundown towns were created overwhelmingly on anti-black racism, nothing else. And it's he says you can find areas where they exclude Jews or so-called Asians and other groups, but the overwhelming pattern, according to Mr. Lowen himself, is excluding black people. Why have a subsection that comes back and contradicts that way this far down in the text? And with nonsense like this, he writes, across America, working class whites today, like in the 21st century, complain about getting stopped and harassed by police in elite white suburbs. Have you all seen the working class White Lives Matter protests? Have you seen those? Have you seen the reports about working class whites being profiled and tased, stopped and frisked, video footage of them being beaten? I haven't seen any of those. If you can find, if they got a website, if they have speakers, if they have a movement or a protest that's coming up, I would like to know. He does have a footnote for that, but it has it's the same type of nonsense that I griped about when we read Black Love is a Revolutionary Act. In fact, I'll read you the footnote. It's footnote 74 for this subsection. So footnote 74, Brooks Blevins, The Strike and the Still, Arkansas Historical Quarterly. Obviously, that's not about current day whites saying that they're getting stopped by police. The Ku Klux Klan in the Southwest, published in 1965. On the last one, Katie Benton Cohen, email 2003. Now, if that last portion is where he's getting this report from, and particularly if you're going to quote this from an email and then say that it's widespread, that this is a problem throughout the nation, that we got an epidemic of working class whites being stopped and harassed by the police in elite white suburbs, I need more detail than that. And he did not provide it on that one. That would be another act of racism, white supremacy, in my view, from Mr. Lowen. Word usage, I thought it was so, I've said repeatedly, terrorism, and pointing out how he does not use the word terrorism in the text. He used a derivative this week, terroristic, but again, it's in quotes. The limited times derivatives of terror, the word terror, are used in the book, they're quoted from someone else. This time when it comes up, This is a quote from Philip Nevelo, the town's, I guess, only black resident, or one of the few black or Jewish residents, excuse me, where he says that schoolmates subjected him to 2 years of anti-Semitic harassment, including threats to hang him. And police charged three students with making terroristic threats. And that's in quotes. Santa Fe's reputation for being white only, in the words of Shelley Kelly, archivist at the University of Houston, surely contributed to the climate of intolerance metaphor with which his parents charged the school district. They were charged with terroristic threats. That should not be the only time in this text that the word terrorism is used. It comes up a few more times in this section that we read today. I'll point those out later. Let's see, I'll share maybe two more, and then I'll check, see if other folks have comments they would like to share. He pointed out that in Hawthorne, California, this is a suburb in LA, that this was a sundown town, and it later became an area where they had a lot of non-white people. And he said the teaching staff was still largely Anglo-white, including many holdovers from its all-white days. And some of them contributed to the problem by refusing to teach works by authors such as Richard Wright and Maya Angelou. I paused. We read the late Dr. Maya Angelou, I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. I don't know which books of hers he wanted to read specifically. I know Richard Wright is read in schools pretty regularly, Black Boy and Native Son. But I thought if they're going to read those two, there's a high likelihood that there will be more representations of black male rapists, because those are main figures. Those the black male rapist is featured in both of their works, Richard Wright's Native Son and Dr. Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. Not that, you know, yeah, we talked about that a lot. The man, not the black male rapist, regular character in American writing, literature. Let's see. The first section, the first sentence in the subsection, inculcating prejudice in the next generation. I think retired firefighter talked about how the word prejudice was used. Totally in terrorism or prejudice. But the first sentence is, cognitive dissonance also helps explain how young whites wind up racist as they mature. I don't know what he means by cognitive dissonance, but in my view, that is another illustration of him practicing racism. Why isn't it that these whites, seeing their parents go out and purge Negroes, going out and engaging in rock throwing where they've killed people, and then going back to brag and talk to their pappies and mammies and uncles and aunts about how they drove out the Negroes, and they get to swap stories about how they've done this for generations. How doesn't that help explain how they became racist? They've had, he gave all these illustrations of 5-year-olds and 6-year-olds saying nigger this and nigger that, and having a parent or someone, a white guardian, step in and say, oh, no, no, no. We don't call them Negroes here. We say Negroes. Then when we get back home, we can say nigger or coon or whatever it is. We can do that again once we get back home. Why doesn't that explain why they're racist and behaving like this in the high schools, bullying, terrorizing, making terroristic threats against so-called Jews and Mexicans and blacks and everybody else who is not white? Why doesn't that explain it, as opposed to so-called cognitive dissonance, whatever that's supposed to mean? That's great in my view. Really important illustration of even whites who are allegedly attempting to work against white supremacy racism, they still practice racism, and they do so in really dangerous ways, because they tend to minimize whites' dedication. Then they'll get mad when I hear my definition. White dedication to racism, white supremacy, explains why when white, and some of them, they're not even mature. He was talking about 5-year-olds going out and doing this. That's it. I'll pause there. The number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. Other folks, if you have a hand up and we missed you, yes, sir, Mr. Demery Four.
Yes, greetings. That's the other callers. This is a firefighter from Florida. A few things here. One, the recording concerning Miss Jenkins' murder that was played earlier, the police didn't respond for over an hour after the call was made the two suspects was harassing a black female, and it said that the police were more concerned about a black person in Martinsville after dark than they were about investigating the suspects or even the black female's murder after the fact. And I did point out, I wrote down that whites, he mentioned that whites that don't go to school with blacks, I guess, are more likely to be intolerant of blacks. But in my experience, being around blacks does not mean that whites would practice racism less. As a matter of fact, it's just the opposite. The more they're around blacks, the more opportunity they have to practice racism. And also I mentioned, like you said, he's mentioning sundown towns and conflating the issue with gays, Jews, Catholics, hippies, and other whites to minimize the effects that racism has, especially on black people. And he pointed out in the readings that although prejudice, he was using the word prejudice, was shown towards other groups, then it was most, I think that they looked at blacks as being the most vicious. And I'll mute my line on that. The search paper call.
Much obliged, Mr. Demery Four. If other folks have commentary, *61, if anything. Thoughts, questions stood out from the first audio segment. I'll share a few more notes that I took and keep an eye on the switchboard for other questions or calls. Let's see. In the same section where he talked about inculcating prejudice in the next generation, he mentioned it was basically saying that how white children, they grow up in these sundown towns and they're just going to turn into little racists. He says, you can have a few exceptions. He mentions John Wooden, the famous UCLA basketball coach, grew up in notorious Martinsville, where they killed Carol Jenkins in Indiana. He had coached such famous African-American basketball players as Kareem Abdul-Jabbar and Sidney Wicks. That is true. He did coach Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. That, however, does not disqualify him from being a suspected racist. There are many individuals classified as white who have coached black people in basketball, football, baseball, or any other endeavors, and they have still practiced racism, white supremacy. So just because John Wooden did, you know, a wonderful job, coached Kareem Abdul-Jabbar to three NCAA championships, that does not mean he wasn't racist. And even that is an illustration. The one white person that we can come up with as a non-racist from a sundown town is a basketball coach of a black guy. I mean, that's right in the blind side. That's standard stereotype. You can have a big, brawny, 7-foot beast, Shaquille O'Neal type, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, but you got to have white brains to get things done, to win those championships. Got to have a white man in charge. Let's see. He says, all the while, when whites do not go to school with blacks and do not live with blacks, and everyone in town knows this results from whites' choices and policies, it is hard for children to conclude that blacks are okay. Logically, they may infer quite the opposite. Again, you've already said they have signs up that say no nigger in town. The racist jokes that he already talked about. They have mascots, nigger this and nigger that. They have nicknames calling black people Snowball. It wouldn't be an inference. They would have heard directly. And it's, again, these are major acts of racism, in my view, just saying, hey, white children are trained to be racist. That's very different than, oh, well, there are no niggers around.
and they don't see any niggers. Bill Cosby's not even on television anymore. Of course they're going to grow up being mal. It sounds like I wrote this down because he kept saying this over and over. It almost sounded like he was talking about affluenza. When the white children in the suburbs, because they've got it, you know, so well, and just the life that they have, it's hard for them to gauge how the world really operates. And they just go out and think they have all this entitlement and expectations. And, you know, it's just like they're almost at a disadvantage. Yeah, affluent. That's what it sounded like he was describing in the text, which I agree with retired firefighter, just another form of racism, white supremacy. And I don't see any evidence of these white children in these towns struggling. If anything, he's listed white people who've gone on to take over the world, who've been major figures in global politics and huge figures in sports and entertainment, all industries, from folks that he's mentioned in the text. Continuing, let's see. In the next session, where he talks about these whites who grew up in these sundown towns allegedly being afraid to venture out, that is a very common notion that is presented in the system of white supremacy, white people being afraid to go to areas where there are a lot of black people and this negrophobia in general. Every time we've said, I think many of us, that the fear is the threat of white genetic annihilation. It is not some sort of fear of black people. And the folly of it all is that the example presented was, oh my goodness, why would you want to live in Washington, D.C.? Oh my goodness, what a frightful thing. This book was published in 2005. It's not even 15 years totally. And now it's Washington, D.C. is not Chocolate City. Fearful whites, I guess, got over their phobias and decided that, hey, Washington, D.C. is pretty cool. It'd be even cooler if we moved those niggers out and we took over. And that's exactly what they've done. Dr. Welsing talked about that quite a bit, too. White theory of genetic annihilation and whites not being afraid coming in D.C. and booting out black people like her neighbors and trying to move her, elbow her out as well. And white children were involved in that, too. They had the daycare. She talked about that all the time, the role of white children in purging black people. Once again, you can add Dr. Welsing to that list of victims. Let's see. Next. He talked about in many of these whites leaving. When they wanted to leave areas like Detroit or other so-called major cities, they wanted to leave and go to predominantly white areas, and how this trend continues. That's been, it seems, the case for at least a century. White people bragging about having these areas and this being something to attract and promote other whites to want to come and live in our super cool area with no niggers. Mr. Fuller confirmed that, too, when I was talking to him about this text. It's codified in so many different ways. Again, I just go back. This is not cognitive dissonance. If you're a child, you would hear all of these cues and get direct information on how to practice, administer white supremacy yourself. In addition to hearing people say it's not uncommon experience in Polk County to hear a newcomer remark that he chose to move here because of low taxes and no niggers. Now, if that's common, I mean, hey, you don't have to infer a whole lot. You're getting direct information about what it means to be white and what niggers are, even when to say nigger and when not to say nigger. Sometimes you switch it up on them and give them the Negro. Let's see. Had another person move from Chicago. He said it was not uncommon for folks moving down here from Chicago, from the Chicago area, to retire, to openly remark that one attraction of the Rogers area was that there were no blacks. A resident of Pana, Illinois, told that white Chicagoans also moved there to retire, knowing its anti-black traditions and have radically racist ideas. Whatever that means. That's when he said before, because he talked about the radical period of Negro culture from 1969 to 1972. It was militant. That was what it was. The militant era of Negro culture from 1969 to 1972. What do you call this? What is, give me an explicit definition of what militant Negro culture is for that period, and then break it down, because he didn't provide enough information in this footnote either. What are radically racist ideas? And in the context of this book, where we've had bombings, shootings, purgings, killing children. They said no one, written out explicitly, no one will be spared. What are radically racist ideas? Man, that's in quotes in the book, too. Let's see. I had some folks in different areas. This would just be a recommendation. If you have the text, you can probably get this book easily at your local library or university library or an ebook copy. If you're interested in local history, if you've heard your state mentioned, either state where you grew up, state where you currently reside, and you want to do research on local history, check the footnotes because he mentions a lot of books that offer a lot of local history. I've been trying to go through and check myself. So if you, hey, you have connections to Arkansas, you have relatives maybe that have connections to Michigan or Indiana or Kentucky or wherever, just make notes and check the footnotes when you hear those states mentioned and see what books he references and or even what professors, authors are being referenced. You might be able to find these folks online, drop them an email, and get more resources. Check out some of your local museums and libraries as well. They'll probably have great information also. I thought it was important. He mentioned the intelligence report. This is all I'm reading. The intelligence report put out by the Southern Poverty Law Center is the most complete national list of extreme right-wing and racist organizations. And he talks about how many of the groups listed on this report are in sundown towns, their headquarters. That's important, but I think it's equally important. The Southern Poverty Law Center, I've mentioned them before. They should not be recognized or thought of the same way as James Loewen as not racist. The Southern Poverty Law Center, they just had that big report about how they are being accused and battling allegations of practicing racism themselves and mistreating non-white staff members and the exact same thing, having all white people, I think it was all white males, in positions of power and decision-making in the group. That's not white privilege. Wrong P word, white power. Even the SPLC, Southern Poverty Law Center. Let's see. He said at the beginning of the section, the effect of sundown towns on blacks, he said, in conversation with each other, many African Americans believe that when racial privilege, whatever that means, is at stake, Caucasians, the term often used, are to be feared. In quotes, whites will stop at nothing, a sociologist friend said to me. I thought he was overstating his case. Now, I thought that was extremely important right there. In my view, that is like an example of you don't say nigger, you say negro. I'm giving a metaphor. You don't say nigger, you say negro. I'm not going to say that this is a no good line nigger, but I'll say I thought he was overstating his case. Why would you think he's overstating his case that whites will stop at nothing to maintain racism, white supremacy? Why would you think he's overstating his case? Given what you know, to put this book together, Lies My Teachers Told, purging all of these black people from all of these areas, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of areas, why would you think that's an overstatement? Another act of racism, white supremacy on Mr. Loewen's part, in my view. The last one or two, they had the section, they had the white woman talking apparently with fear. She was talking to a few other white people about why she lived in a predominantly black area. And they said, why do you live there with all the blacks? And she said that she loved having sex with them. The tackiness, that's certainly a cowbell. I guess that's supposed to be processed, thought of as, oh, what a quip from a white ally, you know, I'll show them. No, that's not how it's processed in my view at all. In a system of racism, white supremacy, which is what white women would frequently be accused of anyway. That you could even hear that sometimes in the civil rights movement. That's why you're there, to do some slumming with the niggers, get involved in some sexually depraved activities. That would be the accusation, which he already mentioned in the text. Anyway, white people would do this, set up houses of prostitution in predominantly black areas. But I thought that was extremely suspicious that that would be the response. Why are you there with the niggers? Because I enjoy having sex with them. And I also thought that that might have been one where maybe she was presenting truth under the guise of this is a joke or I'm an anti-racist, maybe she was actually telling the truth. Sometimes that's the way it is in the system of white supremacy, where there's so much deception. Sometimes you get truth in obvious and unexpected places. I'll pause there. Any other comments folks wanted to make sure that they get in before we... Oh, wait a minute. I think I got to actually make sure I get this one in too. Tara, yeah, because I had said something about Tara. Words are important. He says that black people feeling ill at ease. He talked to a black female who said that her father refused to take a vacation. Part of that was because he was worried about being terrorized on the road. That's in quote, terrorized, mentioned again. And then he starts terrorized, but he puts it in quotes, is an appropriate word choice because segregation, and especially sundown towns, rest ultimately on the threat of terror. If that's the case, he should be using the word terror, terrorized, terrorism throughout the book, certainly more so than privilege and prejudice and all this other nonsense, racism. But he doesn't do that. And acknowledging that, yes, this is the accurate word to you. I thought that was so appropriate. He says appropriate, accurate, same thing. Those are synonyms. Knowing that this is the accurate word to use and not using it further confirms you're deliberately practicing racism, in my view, Mr. Lowen. He comes back over on the same page. He's talking about a road trip by a black female that was made in the 1960s. If you will recall, my parents had gone to Greenwood to pick up a puppy from one of my mother's coworkers who lived there. I overheard the grown-ups talking about how we had to get out of town because black people were not allowed in town after dark. I remember being terrified, sitting in the back seat of our car, holding my new puppy as we drove from Greenwood to Indianapolis. I believe this memory is behind my fear of driving rural highways and traveling through small rural towns, particularly Indiana. Indiana is where Carol Jenkins was killed. That's not prejudice. That's not white privilege. That is terrorism. And I mean, that is the correct word usage because that's what happens. You get these events of trauma, violence, and then you end up having lasting fear, trepidation around anything that is associated with that event. That is textbook explanation of PTSD and terrorism. Did I hear any other folks have a comment they wanted to get to before we get to the second audio segment?
Yes, sir.
Retired firefighter.
Part of the, yes, sir. Part of the, first, segment was talking about, Florida, which is, with its extensive, sundown towns, that sort of thing, down here in, South Florida. Miami, to be exact, black male, I think was the first black millionaire, D.A. Dorsey, who was a banker, real estate, basically sold an island that he owned off the coast, off the mainland coast of Miami, and returned the people who bought it, renamed it Fisher Island. The white male that was discussed in the first reading as the so-called discoverer of the place that's called Miami Beach. Yeah, just thought I'd put that little tidbit in the first reading based on that report that was on the state of Florida and Miami.
Much obliged. I think he talked about Miami having the highest rate of segregation in the country in some of those areas of Florida, even higher than some of the other areas that we traditionally think of in the South. And he mentioned that that wasn't just whites from the so-called South. That was whites who come from New York and other northern areas to retire, come with those same racist values. That we're not going to have any Negros messing things up in wonderful South Florida. Got another thing coming if you think you're going to botch our sunshine with those shady Negros.
One thing I always thought, well, not always, but in the aftermath of quote-unquote growing up, the early part of my childhood, my father was with us, mother and five children, and we never would travel outside of the confines of Miami-Dade County that I can recall. And I think it has something to do with what they were talking about the, not just the
advent of terror that was possible. Also, the advent of embarrassment. Nigga, get out of here. No, you and your children cannot use the bathrooms. Go out over in the bushes and pull down your pants. I just suspect what I knew about my father, that he did not want to be affected by that embarrassment, that type of thing. And so we didn't travel outside of the Dade County that I can recall growing up as a child. And I think that had a whole lot to do with it. I can recall, though, probably the most fun I ever had at a beach was, I think at some point in time, they opened up the northern part of South Florida's beach, which is called Holliver Beach. And that was the first time I ever saw waves because you were right on the ocean then. Prior to that, black people were restricted to the Virginia Key Beach, which was actually adjoined to a large raw sewage plant. This particular property was at, and it was full of holes on this surface, full of holes from what they call land crabs who dug holes into this area that, you know, primarily, you know, wasn't prime as far as the beach is concerned, full of mosquitoes and whatnot, that sort of thing. Sand fleas also. That was the black beach at the time. Thank you.
Done deliberately, that sort of activity to give black people the worst possible conditions, spaces to live in, or park or whatever it is, recreational area, they call it. Just with the importance of words and language, why I even said the white woman who said that her witty reply when they said, you know, why are you a white woman living over there with those niggers? And her response was that she liked to have sex with them. And I said that sort of thing is important. And in my view, that's another act of racism potentially, because I look at different portions of the text when it says the largest single expulsion took place in the late summer of 1916. City Assessor F.W. Little blamed that riot on the influx of Detroiters who, feeling the penetration of Negroes in Detroit, sought Wyandotte real estate on the basis of their past knowledge of the anti-Negro attitude in Wyandotte. Just that language, the penetration of the Negroes, prompted them to move. Sounds sexual, particularly when, again, the Negro male menace and raping Negro males is often used as an excuse to lynch one or even purge an entire area of black people. Just that languaging seemed sexual at some level or another. You all can let me know if that is not your interpretation. We will go ahead and get to the second audio segment. If folks have additional comments or questions, write them down, and we should have time once the second audio segment concludes. We are picking up on the subsection, Black Avoidance Helps Maintain Sundown Towns. This is James Lowen. Sundown Towns, A Hidden Dimension of American Racism, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number two.
Black Avoidance Helps Maintain Sundown Towns. Today, residents of all white towns and suburbs often blame African Americans for being overly cautious. A longtime resident of Arab, Alabama, thinks so. After telling how whites used to keep African Americans out of Arab even during the day, he assured me in 2002 it'd be different now. Of course, blaming blacks for not moving in serves as a handy excuse for whites who don't want to acknowledge that their town ever had a policy to keep them out. However, sometimes whites have a point. Certainly, African American sociologist Orlando Patterson thinks they do. Persisting segregation is partly, and for most middle-class Afro-Americans, largely a voluntary phenomenon. In response to the civil rights movement, whites lost some of their sense of privilege, especially in the South. No longer do most whites assume they're entitled to exclude African Americans. On public opinion polls, fewer and fewer whites agree with such items as blacks shouldn't push into areas where it's known they're not wanted. Ironically, however, in the black community, pessimism about white attitudes has grown. In 1968, 47% of African Americans felt whites wanted to see blacks get a better break. 31% thought them indifferent, and 22% thought whites wanted to keep blacks down. By 1992, just 22% of African Americans believed whites wanted to see them get a better break, 52% thought them indifferent, and 26% felt whites wanted to keep them down. Such pessimism is hardly conducive to social action. Most black families merely follow the line of least resistance. In 2001, reporter David Mendel spoke with 66-year-old Willie Buchanan, who bought a house in Blackfish Bay, as WAGs call the majority black neighborhood near Whitefish Bay, an overwhelmingly white suburb north of Milwaukee. Buchanan said he moved where he felt most comfortable, according to Mendel. "You like to live around people who you feel want to be your neighbor," said Buchanan. "I don't think prejudice is as bad as it used to be, but it's still around, so I just decided to move here." Such thinking's understandable. Law professor Cheryl Cashin calls it integration exhaustion. As actor Sidney Poitier put it, explaining why the Poitier family moved to Mount Vernon, an interracial suburb of New York City, after having problems trying to buy a house in West Los Angeles, "Our children are established in a multiracial community in Mount Vernon. They attend multiracial schools. We don't want to barter that kind of atmosphere for something that's hostile." Ruby Dee, another black actor who, with her husband Ossie Davis, chose an already integrated neighborhood in New Rochelle, New York, offered a similar explanation. "I want to be friends with my neighbors. I don't want to be tolerated, on my best behavior, always seeking my neighbor's approval. I admire the pioneers who risk so much in the process of integration, but I can't break that ice." Reasonably enough, many African American families want to live near neighbors who'll accept them. And the best way to find whites like that is in neighborhoods where they already live near African American families. Choosing this line of least resistance may not lead to the best results for the family in the long run, however. African Americans moving into those neighborhoods that are known to be open to them often wind up in areas with higher tax rates and lower tax bases than whiter suburbs. Eventually, these economic realities take their toll, and families find that their homes didn't appreciate as fast as those in whiter suburbs. Cashin points to a host of more serious social problems that arise after suburbs go majority black. Certainly, following the line of least resistance doesn't lead to the best results for the metropolitan area. When black families move to an interracial suburb that everyone knows is open, indeed, that is likely to go all black, they only contribute to the sundown suburb problem. Nevertheless, calling African American complicity in residential segregation voluntary overstates the case. According to sociologist Gary Orfield, speaking in 2000, African Americans do still believe in the integrated American dream. 99% favor desegregation, and 59% favor busing if needed to get there. worry about sundown reactions deters many. In Detroit, Reynolds Farley and others pointed out, only 31% of African Americans said they'd be willing to be the African American pioneer on an all-white block in 1992, compared to 38% in 1976. But sociologist John Logan stresses, black preferences are strongly affected by beliefs about whites' attitudes and behavior. So their reluctance to live in a predominantly white neighborhood is due to their belief that whites would react negatively. Reputations are important. In Arab, for instance, the 2000 census showed just a single black household among 7,139 total population. Why so few? I asked a longtime resident. He referred to the violent exclusion of the past. That happened a long time ago, and it's still on their, blacks, minds. Before smiling at the old ex-CCC worker who still avoids Taft 6 decades after he learned it was sundown, we might note that Taft also didn't change for decades. According to Ronald McGriff, chair of social sciences at the nearby College of the Sequoias, as recent as the 1980s, residents of Taft trashed a black home with paint and graffiti, and the family was told to get out of town. Before making light of the black man who'd come for Sunday dinner in Paxton, only if his white host drove him, whites might remember that one can never be sure when one's car might break down. Before blaming African Americans for not moving into Arab, we must note that Arab boasted a sign, "Nigger, don't let the sun set on your black ass in Arab, Alabama," until the early 1990s, according to Benjamin Johnson, a former University of Alabama student, hardly a long time ago. I must confess that I felt unsafe and uneasy when I first started doing this research in such notorious sundown towns as Alba, Texas, and Cicero, Illinois. I worried lest they discover my liberal attitudes before I fully understood that my white skin made me safely part of the in-group. David Gran, a New Republic journalist visiting Vidor, Texas in 1998, made light of African Americans' continued concern about that town. Several blacks in the surrounding area told me they still don't stop there for gas at night, even though the hand-painted sign on Main Street saying, "Nigger, don't let the sun set on you in Vidor," was taken down some 30 years ago. He obviously thought African Americans were overdoing their prudence. But if one doesn't know for sure, one is putting oneself and one's family at risk. African Americans have a legitimate right to fear violent consequences, as well as such lesser repercussions as shunning if they move into a sundown community. Moreover, just 5 years before Grand's visit, racial slurs, shunning, refusals to hire, and death threats drove 4 black households from Vidor's public housing complex, leaving the town again all white by design. This book is replete with examples of vicious white retribution visited upon unsuspecting African Americans who didn't know enough to be wary of sundown towns and might have survived had they been more prudent. Today, most sundown towns and suburbs would react more placidly than Vidor back in 1993. But some residents might not be welcoming. As an elderly African American in a neighboring town said in 2002, explaining why there are no African Americans in Nashville, Illinois, If people are inhospitable to you, you leave. Still, African Americans can overdo their caution into their own form of racial paranoia. Sometimes, African Americans take a certain pleasure in overstating the danger. Look what those white folks have done now. There's a streak of gallows humor in black rhetoric that takes mordant satisfaction in seizing on, retelling, and even exaggerating examples of racist white behavior. Patterson writes that African Americans perceive whites as technically clever, yes, powerful, well-armed, and prolific, to be sure, but without an ounce of basic human decency. Despite all the wretched acts by whites recounted in this book, that's too strong. Such thinking only exaggerates the extent and importance of white racism and invites African Americans to show too much caution. The African American woman who was not happy about having to go to Effingham, Illinois in broad daylight in 2002 showed this paranoia just like the white suburbanite from Naperville who frets about going to a concert in Chicago's Loop. In both cases, a self-fulfilling prophecy sets in. Nothing bad happens to the person who avoids places dominated by the other race, and that happy fact legitimizes the avoidance, leaving intact the belief that the opposite race still poses a threat. Psychological costs of sundown towns. No other group, not even Native Americans, has been so disparaged by the very structure of American society. No other group has been labeled a pariah people, literally to be kept outside the gates of our sundown towns and suburbs. As Daisy Myers put it in 1960, the housing market, above all else, stands as a symbol of racial inequality. Just as sundown towns drain the morale of African Americans during the nadir, so sundown suburbs, especially elite suburbs, still contribute to demoralization in black neighborhoods elsewhere in the metropolitan area. Arna Bontemps and Jack Conroy observed about Watts, the African-American ghetto that exploded into violence in Los Angeles in 1965, a crushing weight fell on the spirit of the neighborhood when it learned that it was hemmed in, that prejudice and malice had thrown a wall around it. On the other side of the country, Irwin Quinton moved in 1961 to North Amityville, one of the black townships that adjoin sundown suburbs on Long Island. He remembered in 2003 how other growing Long Island communities, Levittown in particular, made it clear that they didn't want blacks. The message, hammered home to black suburbanites by their neighboring all-white community, is, "We don't care who you are or what you've done. So far as this town is concerned, you're a nigger and unfit for human companionship." Partly as a result of this message, North Amityville, Kinloch, Missouri, and several other black townships lost morale and came to house drug markets and problem families. Successful African Americans may be particularly upset by these slights because their peers, elite whites, are the least likely of all white Americans to accept African Americans into their neighborhoods and organizations. As Ellis Coase famously raged, "I've done everything I was supposed to do. I've stayed out of trouble with the law, gone to the right schools, and worked myself nearly to death. What more do they want? Why, in God's name, won't they accept me as a full human being?" It is frustrating. Even voicing the hurt can hurt because it can seem as if affluent African Americans are only whining because white people won't be their friends. A similar misinterpretation gets applied to school desegregation. What is it about black people? Do they need white children next to them to learn successfully? But that wasn't Coase's point in 1993, nor was it the point of Brown versus Board of Education in 1954. As the Supreme Court pointed out in decisions flowing from Brown, whites are the lawmaking group in America. When they segregated the schools, it was part of a program of white supremacy that declared blacks inferior. That's why segregated schools were inherently unequal, as the Brown decision stated. The enforced racial separation itself both presupposed and signified black inferiority. Every time black ingress into a previously white neighborhood prompts white egress to more distant sundown suburbs, all African Americans in the metropolitan area are invited to remember that they're still so despised by our mainstream culture that whites feel they must flee them en masse. Black poet Langston Hughes mused on this matter in 1949 in Restrictive Covenants, which said in part, "When I move into a neighborhood, folks fly. Even every foreigner that can move, moves. Why?" Coase goes to the heart of the matter. Residential exclusion and the school segregation it purchases strikes at blacks' worth as full human beings. That's why it festers. That's why black respondents on Long Island were significantly less satisfied with their lives than whites with significantly lower incomes, in a 1990 study reported by Coase. After experiencing some of Chicago's sundown neighborhoods and sundown suburbs firsthand in 1965, Martin Luther King, Jr. observed, "Segregation has wreaked havoc with the Negro. Only a Negro can understand the social leprosy that segregation inflicts upon him. Every confrontation with restriction is another emotional battle in a never-ending war." Social leprosy is an evocative term for the pariah status that sundown towns and suburbs enforce upon African Americans. Inexact only in that leprosy can now be cured. County Collins' poem, Incident, written in the 1920s, suggests the sting that African Americans can internalize from racial slights. "Once riding in old Baltimore, heart-filled, head-filled with glee, I saw a Baltimorean keep looking straight at me. Now I was 8 and very small, and he was no whit bigger, and so I smiled. But he poked out his tongue and called me nigger. I saw the whole of Baltimore from May until December. Of all the things that happened there, that's all that I remember." Such behavior wasn't limited to an 8-year-old white boy in Baltimore in 1911. As we've seen, residents of sundown towns persist in expressing racial slights and taunts. Young black adults have supplied many examples of being called nigger and worse in these towns in the last 10 years, such as this experience by a high school athlete in Pekin in central Illinois in 1999. "In track, I was the conference champion in the 3,200 meters, and in cross country, I was the conference and sectional champion. One occurrence that I would never forget about running cross country is when I had a meet in Pekin, Illinois. While running along the course, someone riding alone in a car shouted out the word nigger. This was my first time experiencing racism. Throughout my years of living in Peoria, I'd never been in the act of racism. Till this day, I can remember this occurrence very visually. This event made me aware that racism does still exist in the 90s. And till this day, the memory sears. Internalizing low expectations. Since the 1970s, the research literature in social science and education has stressed that the expectations teachers and others have of children, and ultimately the expectations children have of themselves, make a key difference to their performance in school and later life. And expectations vary by race and class and sometimes gender. If teachers think of African-American children as less intelligent, they'll expect less from them. Soon they get less from them. After a while, African-American children may start expecting less from themselves. The generalizations that are intrinsic to sundown towns and suburbs, that African-Americans must be kept out because they're problematic people who are likely to be intellectually inferior, if not criminal, pervade our general culture. Sociologists Dale Harvey and Gerald Slayton demonstrated how teachers have internalized these expectations. They showed photographs of children to teachers and found them all too willing to predict different levels of school performance based solely on snapshots. White children were more often expected to succeed and black children more often expected to fail, they summarized. Unfortunately, these lower expectations can become self-fulfilling prophecies for some members of the oppressed group. African Americans in segregated environments can find it hard to break out of this cycle of lower expectations and inferior self-worth. De facto segregation is no kinder to the excluded minority than the old de jure segregation that the Supreme Court threw out as unconstitutional in 1954. Besides, as this book has shown, sundown towns are all white by policy and official actions, not just de facto. All black schools often do not, and sometimes cannot, convince black children they're fully equipped genetically and intellectually to challenge the white world. Since the raison d'etre for segregated schooling was, and is, to keep an allegedly inferior group from contaminating and slowing the progress of white students, it can be hard for teachers in black schools to convince their charges that they're fully equal and ready to take on all comers. Segregation promotes the devaluation of black life, even among blacks, and can lead to self-hatred, wrote psychiatrist Alvin Poussin in 2002. In this respect, teachers in segregated black schools face the same uphill battle faced by teachers in segregated white schools in sundown suburbs, who are trying to convince their charges that blacks are fully equal. All the while, the act of living in sundown neighborhoods and attending all-white schools communicates to everyone in the society that whites are superior. So does the higher prestige accorded to whiter suburbs. The ideology underlying sundown communities relies on stereotypes about African Americans, stereotypes that unfortunately reach African Americans. Claude Steele and his associates at Stanford show that these stereotypes can then dramatically depress the performance of African-American students on the SAT and similar tests, a phenomenon Steele calls stereotype threat. In subtle experiments, Steele has created stereotype threats for white students that depress their performance, and the same for women as a group, and so forth. Thus, books such as The Bell Curve, which claims African Americans have lower intelligence genetically, in turn helped to maintain precisely the lower test scores that they claim to explain, by maintaining the stereotype that African Americans are inferior. All this is why Malcolm X famously said, "A segregated school system produces children who, when they graduate, graduate with crippled minds." Black parents try to convince their children that they're valuable human beings. But it's not easy when society devalues them. It's also hard to answer such logical questions as, why are we in the ghetto? Why do whites move away? As an 8-year-old black child said to Jacob Holt, commenting on this white antagonism, "We must have done something wrong." And lo, the old blacks as problem ideology, expressed so clearly in the origin myths of sundown towns, surfaces miles away in the minds and mouths of the victims. Excluding African Americans from cultural capital. Residential segregation makes it easier to give African Americans inferior educations, health care, and other public services. Study after study has shown how expenditures per pupil are higher in suburban schools than in inner cities, even though everyone knows that suburban pupils have many advantages, from their own computers to a higher proportion of two-parent households, that make them easier to teach. Katie Haycock of the Education Trust notes the incongruity. "We take the kids who are most dependent on their teachers for academic learning and assign them teachers with the weakest academic base." Residential segregation not only makes this systematic disadvantaging possible, it makes it desirable, even prestigious, in the eyes of white suburbanites. Confining most African Americans to the opposite of sundown suburbs, majority black, inner city neighborhoods, also restricts their access to what Patterson calls cultural capital, those learned patterns of mutual trust, insider knowledge about how things really work, and counter-rituals and social sensibilities that constitute the language of power and success. Sundown suburbs shut blacks out from coming into contact with these patterns of the dominant culture, at least before college. This cultural segregation shows up even in something as basic as patterns of speech. Many African Americans sound identifiably black on the telephone. Their accent and voice timbre are different. The difference is not racial. Chinese Americans I knew in Mississippi in the 1960s either spoke Southern white English, more than half, Southern black English, a few, or Chinese-accented English, many persons older than 40. Historian Barbara J. Fields points out that there's no such thing as black English in England, where West Indian immigrants' children learn the English of their class and region. But in America, as a consequence of the Great Retreat, black English intensified. In turn, not coming into contact with patterns of the dominant culture is one reason why African Americans, and to a degree Hispanics and Native Americans, average much lower scores than European Americans on college entrance exams such as the SAT. The SAT and related tests suffer from racial and class and some gender bias. This unfairness is in addition to such problems as the far greater access white students have to coaching classes and personal tutors. It derives from the statistical methods the Educational Testing Service, the administrator of the SAT, uses to select items to be included on the tests. Until this bias is eliminated, African Americans need exposure to the vocabulary and thought ways of white suburbanites to do well on standardized tests. Sundown suburbs prevent that by keeping black children away from high-scoring white children, as well as from the amenities that help them score high. Research in Chicago by James Rosenbaum and others confirms Patterson's general point. The Chicago Housing Authority, CHA, burned by the white resistance to African Americans who tried to live in airport homes after World War II, changed its policies to comply with sundown suburbs and neighborhoods. It built public housing for blacks in black neighborhoods and public housing for whites in white neighborhoods. As a result, CHA was sued for racial segregation in what became known as the Gautreaux litigation. In 1969, Federal Judge Richard Austin ordered CHA to locate public housing for blacks in predominantly white neighborhoods scattered throughout the city. Eventually, the relief was ordered to extend to the white suburbs as well. The result, getting underway in 1976, located more than 5,000 families in more than 100 predominantly white communities in Cook County and five suburban counties. Rosenbaum took advantage of the marvelous natural experiment provided by this order. He compared families that happened to get selected for housing in white neighborhoods with families that applied but were not selected. He found that being exposed to new surroundings had transforming effects on the families placed in white neighborhoods. 95% of their children graduated from high school, and 54% went on to college. Both of these rates were higher than for European Americans nationally. Black parents in suburbia were also much more likely than parents in inner cities to find work in the suburbs. Rosenbaum concluded that residential segregation was itself the problem, promoting hopelessness and keeping poor black families from connecting with the larger society. Even apparently unrelated social problems, such as crime and school dropout rates, turn out to be related to residential segregation, according to research by Wayne State University professor George Galster. He analyzed the segregation level and various quality of life indicators across U.S. cities based on the 1990 census. Looking at Detroit, America's most segregated metropolitan area, he concluded that if its segregation level were cut in half, the median income of black families would rise 24%, the black homicide rate would fall 30%, the black high school dropout rate would fall 75%, and the black poverty rate would fall 17%. The Galster and Gautreaux research shows that blaming the pathological conditions of ghetto neighborhoods on their inhabitants gets causation, at least partly, backward.
Trying to get the audio switched off. We'll pick up next week. As I said, slowly getting towards the end of sundown towns. We still have a ways to go. The number 605. 313-5164, the code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. 614, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you have a question or a comment and you did not get to speak during the first segment when we shared, you should definitely get your hand up now to make sure that we get time to hear from you. We should have ample time to share between now and the close of the broadcast. Just make sure you don't wait till the last few minutes if you have something to share. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed. Nothing exciting stood out first audio segment. I'll share a note or two, tell folks, see if they have any notes that they want to offer from the first section. Let's see, combing through. Let's see, the section. Okay, I shared that one last time. When they said, I want to share that one too. Orlando Patterson, psychological costs of sundown towns. I know this from some of the other texts that I've read. I will concede I have made errors from time to time, so I could be wrong. You all can look for yourself. I'm sure I'm trying to go back through my notes because I looked while we were reading. So Orlando Patterson is a black male victim of racism, white supremacy. He's a professor at Harvard University. He's been there for a number of years, and he's published quite a few books, mostly about racism. I think pretty much every time I've seen his scholarship or someone reference him, it's dealing with racism in some respect. He has a lot of work that deals with slavery. He, unless I have been misinformed, is married to a white woman, Anita Rose. I'm trying to make sure I get her last name, but they have a photograph of them together. She could be, perhaps, I guess, a really pale, non-white person. That's why I said I'm totally willing to concede. I have made errors from time to time with regards to who gets classified, accepted as white, and who, you know, is a non-white person or what have you, but I think his white wife might be classified as a white person, Cowbell, and I thought that was significant because Mr. Lowen quotes Orlando Patterson in the section about black people avoiding sundown towns, and that helps to maintain all this, where he says, Orlando Patterson, this is a quote from him, persisting segregation is partly and for the most and for most middle-class Afro-Americans, largely a voluntary phenomenon. And he goes on to talk about this, how for some black people, and he quotes like Ruby Dee and these other black, I guess, entertainers that say that they do not want to go to these hostile racist environments, that they're okay being in a so-called multiracial environment around other black people or around other non-white people. This entire argument to me does not make sense at all. And Mr. Lowen concedes that later on. All of this, Sidney Poitier, that's another cowbell ring, any victim who says, hey, I've seen how whites behave worldwide, and I am not going to subject myself or my children or my family to this additional terrorism and violence, much less even once we get into the house. He presented examples of blacks being dragged out of the house and their the house set on fire and all the rest of it. Why would I subject myself to that? And in addition, I might not even be allowed. Sometimes you had to have a white person who, you know, could finagle the finances to get you the property and all that. You might not even have the resources in place to make that happen. I feel like it's totally a dishonest presentation. And again, it's moving things away from the people that are most to blame for all of this are whites. Even if black people said, I never wanted to be around a white person ever. That would be a logical response to racism, white supremacy. Whites would be even be most to blame for that. There shouldn't even be a section here titled Black Avoidance Helps Maintain Sundown Towns, when he's already said sometimes niggers would get there and they wouldn't even sell them gas, in addition to throwing rocks and killing them on the way out. It says, Safdie quotes Orlando Patterson, a victim of racism, quoting, in my view, inaccurate, illogical information. Then he comes down and he says, on public opinion polls, fewer and fewer whites agree with such items as blacks should not push into areas where it is known they are not wanted. Now, this is what I said before about they can do the refinement. You can do nigger or you can do Negro, maybe even African-American, depending on what time period we're talking. There are polls that have been done like 2014, not ancient history, not even talking 90s or the early 2000s, like 2014, 2015, Melissa Harris Perry had a professor on from Emory University in Georgia who said that the overwhelming number of whites explicitly, they do not want to live around black people. It doesn't matter if the area is pristine, clean, has extraordinary schools and tremendous amenities, no crime and all of that, no pollution. All of that is irrelevant. If it's niggers there, I don't want to be there. And they boiled it down to make it real plain. They didn't get all convoluted. White people, period. It doesn't matter the demographic. It doesn't matter how much education. White people, period, are not interested in living around a substantial number of black people, period. And anytime you move away from that logic of what it means to be white and racism, you just end up in all of this folly. And I felt like there was a lot of that in the section that we had, or the second section in particular. Even the statistics, because he had so many statistics, and I was just looking at these, where it says 47% of African Americans felt whites wanted to see blacks get a break. Confusion, even if that's accurate. And later on, it's 52%. 22%. So this is 1992. 22% of African Americans believed whites wanted to see them get a better break. That's the year of the so-called Rodney King riots in L.A., 1992. Next, said Sidney Poitier, given all the examples. And then, as I said, he concedes himself African American, calling African-American complicity in residential segregation voluntary overstates the case. Then that's, even that is not accurate. It is simply an inaccurate, in my view, a racist way of describing what is happening here. That is not black avoidance contributing to all of this. If anything, that is black people being logical and saying, wow, we have been terrorized and killed for venturing into these areas, sometimes unknowingly, unwittingly. Might be best to avoid. They had the sign up, no niggers allowed. Might be best to steer clear, or at least be gentle when coming in contact with this area. Let's see. Next. He's talking about the loop in Chicago. He says, in both cases, let me make sure I give the full context. The African-American woman who was not happy about having to go to Effingham, Illinois in broad daylight in 2002, showed this paranoia just like the white suburbanite from Naperville who frets about going to a concert in Chicago's Loop. In both cases, a self-fulfilling prophecy sets in. Nothing bad happens to the person who avoids places dominated by the other race. And that happy fact legitimizes the avoidance, leaving intact the belief that the opposite race still poses a threat. That's what I mean. I thought this, the second section specifically that we read, I thought this was the worst section of the book. I thought the racism was extraordinarily glaring, especially in comparison to what might be considered constructive information. It was, the constructive info was lacking. The tackiness was really high. There's no way that you can compare, in my view, logically, and what they say is an intellectually honest way, and say that a white woman or man, racist, who says, oh, I don't want to go to this area because there's a lot of niggers there and I'm scared something will happen, and a black person who says, oh man, that town over there that had the sign no niggers allowed, oh no, I don't want to go there, that town that kicked out all the black people in 1920, oh no, I don't want to go there, the town that's got all the reports of how they've killed and maimed black people, I don't want to go there. That is totally different. And I don't think he presented a single case of a white person when he was talking about these white people that were allegedly born in sundown towns who are fearful of going to places with black people or non-white people. I don't think he presented a single person who said, oh yeah, I was mauled there. I tried to go to that area and the black people grabbed me and beat me down, said they were going to make me pay for what my ancestors did. I don't remember him presenting an anecdote like that. I don't remember him presenting an anecdote of somebody who said, oh, yeah, I don't go down there. They don't like white people. My friends tried to go over there and they told him. They said, oh, no, you better get back over there because we don't tolerate white people over here. Get gone. I didn't hear one illustration like that. It's not. That's exactly what I say on the compensatory call in. Every Saturday, they give these comparisons. This is a major component of white supremacy racism, and this will be presented. A black person who says, oh, no, I don't want to go to a sundown town area is the same as a white person who says, oh, no, I don't want to go to that area with a bunch of black people. If you are confused about racism, white supremacy, which most non-white people are, you will hear a comparison like that, and it will make sense. It will be exactly what he said. What is the last sentence? He says, in both cases, a self-fulfilling prophecy sets in. Nothing bad happens to the person who avoids places dominated by the other race. If someone can point out the area where black people dominate, let me know. And he says, he ends the section. And that happy fact legitimizes the avoidance, leaving intact the belief that the opposite race still poses a threat. Again, unless we're talking about white genetic annihilation, and he is not, has not throughout this book, that is not accurate. Black people do not pose a threat to white people at all. And I think Mr. Lowen knows that. He has not provided an example of that. I'll pause there. Any of the folks that are listening in live, do y'all have additional comments, questions you wanted to share?
Yes, sir.
Retired five.
Yes, sir. We on the COWS program have already dealt with similar ideas with the Little Rock Nine. I think we talked about from the standpoint of by these nine non-white black victims of racist white supremacy taking that risk of was it really worth the years of the consequences, and have that basically straighten out the people activity of education in this part of the world. And I mean, it has not at all. Matter of fact, there's been reports that there's more situations whereas you have schools where the population is either white or non-white now than it was back during that time. And then you're talking about as far as, I mean, this illogical idea, which once again suspected that this white person is practicing racism because of the means that this is not going to solve the problem. You're talking about people like Jackie Roosevelt Robinson. It mentioned about Miami's own and the Bahamas, Sidney Poitier, Bill Russell. I think it was either Bill Russell or Nat King Cole, where a white person broke into their house and defecated on their bed. These type of things were happening for these high profile non-white people that would go into these areas and purchase property and or a house, and the problems that they would have during the entire time that they were in these areas, that it doesn't show any. And then again, with the idea of mine of implying that if non-white black people carry out this process while white people are still practicing racism, white supremacy, that somehow the problem would straighten out. And it is ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense at all. And being that it doesn't make sense, at the same time, is an example of a white person practicing racism by even suggesting something like that. And those are my thoughts on the second reading for the most part.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Let's see. Other folks, if you have comments, questions, *61. I do think, well, I guess let me make sure I get this in first. I thought it was especially tacky. I guess some people might say, I think it was mentioned like months ago, way, way back at the beginning of the text, people were saying, is he referencing black authors in the text? And I said, we've been reading this book for a while. I said, I think at least a month or so ago, probably longer than that. Absolutely. And I'm not even paying attention to that anymore because I'm seeing lots and lots of black authors being referenced. Some of them that I'm familiar with, that we're familiar with. You even quoted Malcolm X this week. There's going to be tons of that. So no problem there. However, I do think it's really tacky, particularly in the section that we read this week, where it's suggesting that there's some sort of similarity between white people who are racist and give racist excuses for avoiding areas with a high population of black people. Sometimes it's even a racist lie about it being a high number of black people in the area. And black people who are fearful about going to an area where whites have terrorized black people and made it clear that we do not allow black people to reside and or even visit this area. And it's enforced with lethal violence. That is totally different. But to have that in a section that every other page he's quoting Malcolm X, Ellis Coase, Sidney Poitier, Ruby Dee, all these black notable black artists and Langston Hughes and all of their poems and what have you to give it some authenticity and richness to the section. It is especially repulsive because he pulls all of these victims and them writing and talking about their experience of being terrorized to then weave lies into that. Sometimes this is how master deceivers, racists, when they write about racism, white supremacy, they're not ignorant. You can't be ignorant about racism and be quoting and have access to the references to quote all these people and to have read all this material to be able to put it together in a cohesive manner. You can't be ignorant, but then to come back and weave that in and then slip in a lie every other sentence. And that's what I'm submitting is happening with some of this, where lies are being slipped in, incorrect terminology, prejudice, white privilege, white people are ignorant, white children become racist because of cognitive dissonance, all of that. These are lies. These are not the accurate words to describe the problem. This is racism, white supremacy, where they are deceiving you about how white people practice racism. All of that is especially dangerous when that gets packaged with, as I said, the Langston Hughes poems, the County Cullen poems, and the like. Continuing. And I do think there's some truth to this notion of black people feeling that they are inferior. I do think that that's accurate. However, that for me loses a lot of the importance when that gets compared to white women. He didn't say white women, but women and gays and all the rest of it. It loses the significance. It loses the importance. Again, if you can find a sign that says no white chicks allowed in town after sundown, or white chicks read and run, if that exists, you can let me know to show that they have these type of anxieties going into tests. But I've seen no evidence of that either. So the conflation, let's see. Peoria, Illinois. That's Richard Pryor again. Let's see. Alvin Poussaint worked with Bill Cosby in putting the Cosby Show together. Sorry, he quotes some of Alvin Poussaint's 2002 work in talking about how black self-respect is harmed and the prevalence of self-hatred. Again, Mr. Lowen is not ignorant, and he's quoting a lot of sources here. Claude Steele got him too. That's another cowbell. I also think it's significant the specific types of black people that are being quoted. I think he quoted Lorraine Hansberry earlier in the book, Raising Poitier. Sidney Poitier actually played in that when they did the film adaptation. But she married a white man. He's quoting Claude Steele here. He's a Stanford University professor, non-white male. He has a white parent, is married to a white person, unless I've been misinformed. I said the same thing about Orlando Patterson, unless I've been misinformed. I also think that that is important when you are selecting victims of white supremacy, but these are non-white people who have been victimized in an extremely intense manner, and they have scholarship that might not be accurate about racism, white supremacy. Certainly, as I said about Mr. Patterson, Claude Steele talked about some of his work before that, in my view, is simply not accurate in terms of what it means to be white what we mean when we say white supremacy racism. Let's see. Other, be missing any other folks have questions, comments they wanted to make sure that they get in? Cultural capital. That's another one. Interesting term that he got from a non-white person, or is quoting this non-white person's interpretation of cultural capital. I'm sure many people have used that term and worked with it, but he's quoting from using the lens of a non-white person to discuss cultural capital and what non-white people allegedly miss out on to not being around whites. All of that, again, the system of racism, white supremacy, you would see these patterns. In fact, I was remembering Stuart Buck's, his work, Acting White, where you don't have to have sundown towns. In a system of racism, white supremacy, you can produce these same results of black inferiority, black self-hatred, black people feeling that they are not worthy and that something is wrong with them and that we are deserving of being treated, mistreated in this manner and terrorized in this manner. You can produce those same results in a town where you have black people and white people living together, living side by side, going to the same school. It's in Stuart Buck's book, Acting White, where in the same school you can have tracking programs where you have the remedial classes, the special needs programs. You just pile up niggers in those classes and say, oh man, you all have got these problems and you're just having difficulty reading. And maybe you need some extra assistance. I don't know. And then all of the academically rigorous courses, you stuff all the white children there and you can end up with the exact same results, even though, hey, you have a quote unquote integrated school. Any other folks have comments, questions they wanted to make sure that they share? Soon folks are satisfied. Again, you can learn that the racism, white supremacy is going to be there. If you are reading a text that's been constructed by someone classified as white, I have never read one where I thought, wow, this person was totally honest in the way that they constructed the text. That has not been the case for myself. Maybe such a book exists, so that'll be an exercise in and of itself. However, there are some bits of constructive information in this text. I've made notes about that as we've gone along as well. If you are in an Indiana, a Texas, a Kentucky, an Oklahoma, many of the other regions that have been prominently mentioned in the text, check those footnotes. It can be really easy if you have an ebook, because then you can just do a search by the specific state or whatever it is. So if you're in Kentucky, you can just search the ebook for when Kentucky pops up, or really you can just search the reference section and see, you know, where is Kentucky mentioned and check out the books for Kentucky or Ohio or Michigan or, you know, whatever state that or locale that you're looking at. I am sure you can find some references that would be worthwhile. Arkansas, lots of different, California, lots of different areas mentioned in the text. You should take advantage. I know I myself have made some notes, areas of Washington that I was not familiar with where they had purges. Take advantage. That is one of the ways that we can and should learn about the practice of white supremacy racism. Study local, national, global operations of white supremacy racism. With that, we'll call it a broadcast. We should be here tomorrow. That would be Friday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific, neutralizing workplace racism. Saturday as well, the compensatory call-in, 6 p.m. Eastern, 9 p.m. Pacific. Much obliged for folks tuning in live. I got discombobulated with, as I said, I felt like the racism was higher this week around because it was just a lot of the inaccurate comparisons and what have you. And he was mentioning these non-white victims, but non-white authors who I felt like were not giving accurate information about racism. But that notwithstanding, tomorrow, compensatory call in on Saturday, and we're still coasting in towards the end of the book. I will not lose focus and make sure to include commentary from people who have written in about the different segments as we read. We should have several more weeks to go so I can include their written commentary over the next several weeks. The email untiljustice@gmail.com. If you have written comments you would like to share, untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. www.thewhitetalk.com. With that, much obliged for folks' participation. Reading is more important than watching television, even if it's the NBA Finals. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism, not prejudice, not white privilege. I think we should keep our brain computers working in optimal condition so that we can go about the business of solving the problem. We need logic-based concepts to go about getting a permanent solution to the problem, racist man, racist woman, racist child. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no, including staying off the cell phone if you are in a vehicle. Racists, they are going to look for means to cause us problems and to waste our time. Staying off that cell phone is an easy one, at least while we're in the vehicle. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.